The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Andy Greenberg, and I'm pleased to welcome everybody to this year's edition of the Carol Phillips Memorial Lecture. It's named after my mother, who is a great lover of books and the Free Library. Hard to believe, but we've been doing this for more than 20 years, 20 years of welcoming distinguished women to the Free Library in person or now virtually. It's a group which has included such outstanding authors as Margaret Atwood, Susan Orlean, Nora Ephron, Toni Morrison, Erica Jong, Joyce Carol Oates. We have an incredibly worthy addition to the group this evening. Tonight, I'm delighted to welcome Maggie Shipstead to the Free Library. Maggie Shipstead is the best-selling author of the novels Astonish Me and Seating Arrangements, the latter of which won the Doan Thomas Prize and the LA Times Book Prize for First Fiction. A former Wallace Stegner Fellow at Stanford University and the recipient of a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts, she is a longtime travel writer and has frequently contributed articles to Condé Nast Traveler and Departures. Maggie's latest bestseller, Great Circle, tells the parallel stories of a bold woman aviator and the actor who portrays her on film almost a century later. Great Circle was shortlisted for the Booker Prize and chosen as one of 2021's best books by NPR, The Washington Post, and Time, among others. I'm so excited that she's here to discuss it with us this evening. So please join me in welcoming Maggie Shipstead to the Free Library.
Thanks, Andy. And thanks, Jason, earlier. Hi, everyone. I am Maggie Shipstead. I'm very excited to be talking to you this evening. I am going to share my screen so you can see some slides. This book is a book that sort of that lends itself to some photos. So this is Great Circle. Great Circle is my third novel. It came out in May of last year, and it is about a fictional female pilot named Marion Graves, who disappears in 1950 while trying to fly around the world north-south over the poles. And it's also about a modern movie star named Hadley Baxter, who's playing Marion in a movie about her life and gets drawn into questions of who Marion really was and what happened to her. And it's a book that has a lot of goes a lot of places and through a lot of time periods, which I didn't necessarily anticipate when I started. The book opens in 1909 in a shipyard in Glasgow before Marion's even born. She and her twin brother are effectively orphaned in 1914 in an ocean liner disaster and raised by their dissolute artist uncle in Missoula, Montana in the 20s. Marion flies in Alaska in the 30s, and during World War II, she transports warplanes in the UK. And meanwhile, Hadley's story is sort of interstitially woven through. I have a short 2-minute video I'm going to show. Hopefully the sound and everything works, that I made with my publisher right when the book came out. I think it's a good introduction to the book. And yeah, only 2 minutes.
When I started writing Great Circle, I spent 2 months in Missoula, Montana, where my main character, a pilot named Marion Graves, grows up. In 1950, Marion vanishes while attempting to fly around the world north-south. I set out to find a way to see the polar regions for myself. Interwoven with Marion's story is that of a modern movie star named Hadley Baxter, who is playing Marion in a movie about her life. Like Hadley, I live in Los Angeles. Great Circle is about scale and about freedom, and it's about flight. I'm not a pilot, but while I was writing, I sought out any opportunity to fly on vintage aircraft and gliders and helicopters and planes suited to extreme environments. am a big proponent of window seats. This book is a human story, but it's also meant as a love letter to the planet. Mostly through assignments for magazines, I've had the privilege of seeing places like the remote Ross Sea region of Antarctica, Alaska, the Cook Islands, Greenland, the Canadian High Arctic, the New Zealand subantarctic, and the Himalaya. The end result is that I've become addicted to the feeling of awe. I wanted to give that same hunger to Marianne, but as she points out in the book, there's too much of the world and too little of life. As a reader, I'm always hoping to be transported, especially now. I hope Great Circle takes you somewhere far away and unexpected.
So I grew up in Southern California. I went to Harvard for my undergrad and I studied English and American literature. Wait, there's another chat. Okay, good. I studied English and American literature. Kind of on a whim, my sophomore year, I took a creative writing class and I wrote a creative thesis of short stories, but I didn't really think being an author was viable. And so I graduated. I didn't know what to do with myself. I stayed in Boston for another year, just living with friends. I worked at a law firm because if you're verbal, everyone says to be a lawyer. But I could tell it wasn't for me. And so again, more or less on a whim, I applied to the Iowa Writers Workshop, sort of assuming that I wouldn't get in and that the next year I would do my homework and apply more places. But I got in, and so suddenly I had 2 years where someone was telling me where to be and what to do and where I had funding. And that was really where I became serious about writing fiction, although I still wasn't entirely convinced that this was a viable career. Here I am being serious about writing fiction. This was a Halloween party my second year. So at Iowa, they give a small number of third-year fellowships where it's, again, like a pretty modest amount of funding for a third year where you can go and hopefully write a draft of a book or do research or whatever you need to do. And so I graduated in 2008, and my second year at Iowa, had written a short story about a wedding set on sort of a thinly veiled Nantucket. And it didn't really work as a short story. And my teacher, Ethan Kanan, was like, well, maybe it's too big to be a short story. You know, maybe it should be a novella. And now that I've taught more, I know that that's something you just say. But at the time, I took it very seriously. And so I decided to spend my third year stipend living on Nantucket through the off season and working on this, expanding the short story into a novel. And I thought I would meet people. I never did. I had like a 5-week period where I didn't have a face-to-face conversation with a person, which turned out to be really conducive to drafting a novel, which I had never attempted before. And unfortunately, it's something you can only sort of learn by taking these years-long swings at it. So by the time I finished in the spring of 2009 on Nantucket, I had a complete draft, and I'd also gotten this fellowship to Stanford for 2 years, where it was, again, sort of a funded 2 years where I would go to workshop and have my work critiqued by other writers and have some more time. And so I was there from 2009 to 2011. During which time I did a big revision of seating arrangements and sold it to my publisher, which is Knopf. There is the final draft, or a draft that my editor has marked up, and she still does this. She sends me boxes in the mail that have a printed out manuscript, and then those post-it notes are all her notes. And Great Circle was about twice as long, or more than twice as long as this. So imagine twice as many post-it notes. It's brutal. And so after I finished at Stanford, I had sort of a year before Seating Arrangements would come out. I sold Seating Arrangements in 2010, and it was published in June 2012. So I had started what I thought would be a second novel. It was a retelling of Mary McCarthy's novel, The Group. I didn't really live anywhere. My stuff was in storage in the Bay. I had a dog, but he could sort of stay with my parents. And because Nantucket had been so productive for me, I thought, well, you know, just kind of hit the road for a while and be away from home and work on this retake on The Group. And so I was in Bali for a month, and then I had a fellowship in Paris for 3 months, and I was in Edinburgh for a month. So I had this sort of 5 month stretch. The top picture is Bali. The bottom picture is the studio apartment I was in Paris, and it's in this place called the International City of the Arts, which is kind of the only like ugly, brutalist building right on the Seine and the Marais, and different organizations and countries own these studio spaces, and artists get to go and stay there. It was amazing. But while I was in Bali, I took a little break from this, what I thought would be my novel, and went to revise a short story. And it was a bit of a long short story. It was 45 pages long, and I was going to trim it down. And by the time I was done trimming it down, it was 90 pages. And so I thought, okay, you know, maybe is this a book? And I sent it to my agent. She said, yeah, you know, keep expanding. And so I ended up using this 5 month period to expand that story into a book, which became my second book, Astonished Me, which I sold to my publisher right before Seating Arrangements was published. And so Seating Arrangements came out in June 2012. I did a book tour for it, did lots of publicity. And then fall 2012, and meanwhile now Astonished Me is kind of entering the editorial pipeline. Fall 2012 rolls around. I said, okay, I'm going to get back to my rewrite of the group. I'm going to take a trip. And so I went to Australia and New Zealand for a month. And during this time, the book just completely died on me. Like, it was not going to work. I finally had to face that. And so by the time I got to the airport in Auckland to fly home, I was sort of feeling a little sorry for myself. And, you know, what am I going to write? If you don't have an idea, it feels like you're never going to have an idea again. And then at the airport, I saw this statue, which is of a pilot from New Zealand named Gene Batten, who's the first person to fly solo from England to New Zealand in 1936. And something clicked, and I just thought, oh, I should write a book about an aviatrix. Like, there's something fascinating about that era. And I didn't start right away. I had to sort of finish Astonish Me and promote it and do everything that comes along with the book. But I at least felt secure that I knew what I wanted to write next. So fast forward about a year and a half, and this is right before Astonish Me is going to be published. And I sort of did the same thing I'd always done. I was like, I just need to go somewhere and focus. And at the time, I was trying to figure out where I wanted to live. I still didn't really live anywhere. My parents were in San Diego. The dog was with me sometimes. And so I was kind of auditioning different places to live. And one place I wanted to try was Missoula, Montana, which at the time, Marion, my fictional pilot, this was explained in the silent video, grows up in Missoula, raised by her uncle. But at the time, I thought I would set my aviatrix book in Nebraska. So you can kind of see in these trees, there's a house. And I rented that house through a friend of a friend just on this mountainside. It was amazing. I'm sitting there trying to write about Nebraska. And so in these 2 months I was here, I really didn't get much of a start on my aviatrix book, but I sort of remained committed. So Astonish Me came out and then promoted it, sort of same pattern. And I was getting more serious about the aviation book finally, you know. And so this is my brother. He just retired from the Air Force last year after 20 years, and he hadn't flown for a while. But he was a C-130 pilot. And so he was kind of my primary resource for pilot stuff. I'm not a pilot. I thought about taking flying lessons for this book, and I really didn't want to. Everyone I've known who's a pilot really wanted to be. And I'd seen my brother as a child, just obsessed with airplanes. His destiny seems so clear. And so I said, you know, I think it seems like a sign that I don't want to take flying lessons. I'm not going to. But Matthew, my brother, really helped me as I was sort of trying to begin to plan the book. And I really can't plan out the plots of my book. I just have to start writing. And so, as I said, both my first two books started as short stories. So at least I had a sense of the voice. Some of the plot was in place, maybe. And this book, Great Circle, I was really starting with nothing. All I knew was that this pilot would disappear while trying to fly around the world north-south, and that she would transport warplanes during World War II. And I didn't know anything else. I didn't know there would be a movie star component, for example. So Matthew helped me decide which airplane Marion would fly in her around the world attempt, and he suggested a C-47, which is also called a DC-3 in its civilian incarnation. And we chose this because I was interested in Marion's flight taking place as soon after World War II as possible. And more than 10,000 of these planes were manufactured during World War II. So they're a surplus one she could buy for cheap. They're very rugged. They can be modified to land on ice and snow. Their fuselage can be converted to just hold fuel tanks, which would have been necessary for a flight like this. And he also helped me choose which route she would take around the world. And there are really only sort of two possible lines of longitude you could marginally follow, just given the oceans and the distribution of land and the fuel restrictions of the plane. The other one went through the USSR. And so we sort of thought, 1950, she might have avoided that. So this is from inside the book. And you can see she starts in New Zealand, hits Cook Islands, up and over. And the big sort of question mark about the feasibility of this was Antarctica, because in 1950, there were no permanent bases on Antarctica, and she would have needed to refuel twice. So it was important to me that such a flight be sort of possible. The seasonality is also a problem, because of course it's winter and dark all the time in the North Pole, when it's summer in the South Pole and vice versa. And you would have to sort of prioritize the Antarctic summer, because nobody flew in winter in Antarctica for a very long time and still mostly don't. But there's a historic expedition to East Antarctica, to Mödheim down there, that I timed Marion's flight with so they could theoretically bring her fuel. And then there would have been cache fuel on the other side of the continent here at, we had a series of bases called Little America. And that's where she disappears from. So this was a artist residency I had applied for well in advance of when I went. So lots of these you have to apply for more than a year in advance. And so again, the idea of the book was barely a seed at the time, but I knew it was really important to me to see the polar regions. I just didn't feel like I could adequately imagine them. And I would never say that authors have to visit all the places they write about. It's just not always possible. But I really wanted to. And so this was a trip to Svalbard in the Norwegian High Arctic. And so they loaded up this tall ship with 27 artists of varying disciplines, mostly visual artists. And we sailed around for 2 weeks. You can see the ship anchored down there in that little bay. And people kind of do their art on shore, and the writers would sort of pretend to take notes and hang out. But it was my first exposure to this kind of landscape, and it helped me start to understand what a flight like Marion's would be about and what would have motivated her. So fall of 2014, I finally settled somewhere. I moved to LA. By this point, I'd realized also that since I'd spent 2 months in Missoula, that would actually be a great place to set the book instead of Nebraska, which I'd only driven through. And so that fell into place. That was really helpful. I had decided to live in LA. It was close to my parents, but not too close. I had a built-in group of friends. And so it was about a month into drafting the book or starting to draft it that it occurred to me, or I sat down one day and I wrote a section in the voice of this movie star. And what I was writing had no sort of obvious connection to the aviation book I had started. I'd written the ship launch. I started thinking about Marion as a child in Missoula. And then I wrote this movie star section for those who've read the book. It's when Hadley leaves a nightclub and sort of publicly cheats on her co-star boyfriend. And so the connection wasn't clear, but to me, it just felt like the missing piece. It felt like a different tone. All of my friends in LA work in Hollywood in one way or another. So it's a way to write about Hollywood and also to sort of give myself this lens on Marion, because the reader has a really intimate look at her life. And then Hadley is trying to reconstruct her life kind of from the bits and pieces left behind. And it's sort of this impossible game of telephone. So that's my office in the house where I lived for 7 years, including the time I was writing this book. But I have recently moved. So I did the research because I couldn't plot the book in advance and knew very little about what would happen in it. I didn't really know what I needed to know. So I had started reading books about pilots, particularly female pilots. You can see Amelia Earhart's books and biography, Beryl Markham's book. Those were kind of the obvious ones, but as I wrote, I would sort of understand better what I needed to learn more about. And so I did a lot of reading as I went, books about pilots, about flight, about sort of the geographic places she goes. And it was sort of this, you know, just felt like constantly swimming upstream. It took me 3 years and 3 months to write the first draft of this book, which was 980 pages long. And about 2 years into that, it dawned on me that I wasn't halfway through, even though I'd written more than 400 pages. And that was a really dark day. And I just had to sort of refocus on doing what I could in any given day. And then the editorial process with my editor at Knopf was a lot of trimming and really just small pervasive cuts. But yeah, this is just a cross section of the books I accumulated during the time I was writing. I did make a research trip to the Hoover Institution at Stanford. They have the papers of several American female pilots who went to fly in the UK during the war. There was an organization called the Air Transport Auxiliary that was both men and women, civilian pilots, and they would fly warplanes from a factory to a field or from a field to a repair depot. And I read hundreds of pages of these sort of onion-skinned, single-spaced letters home from some of these women to get a sense of their lives and their day-to-day. And they were trained in a really interesting way where they were trained to fly types of aircraft. And so they would go, you know, be assigned to pick up a plane, and it would be a specific plane they'd never flown before, but they would just look up the specifications in this little notebook that said Ferry Pilot Notes. And just take off in something they'd never flown before. It was very dangerous. They had a similar fatality rate to the RAF. That's the inside of a C-47 at the Aviation Museum in Montana. So kind of in the same time, so I started writing it in earnest in fall 2014. And in late 2014, early 2015, sort of by happenstance, I got offered two travel writing assignments. And the first one was for Condé Nast Traveler and didn't actually involve going anywhere. I just profiled a ballet dancer who lived between New York and Moscow, because my second novel was about ballet. And then I got offered a travel piece to Hawaii for Travel and Leisure. And so this became one of the ways I researched. I pitched stories to the places I wanted to go. And sometimes they would go through. So in the first couple of years, I'd do maybe two assignments, but I think I've taken 21 trips for magazines. And it really helped me get to some of the places Marion went, which I otherwise would not have been able to reach. My first assignment that I pitched and went through was to the New Zealand subantarctic. So these are the islands we visited. Macquarie is actually an Australian territory, and it's about 52 degrees south. this doesn't require sound, but it's a trip that's pretty rough on people who are prone to seasickness. It's just really big seas down there. And this ended up being a trip that really changed my life. It was one of my first exposures to real wilderness and to wildlife. This is on Macquarie Island, this top picture. I would never approach a wild animal, but these elephant seals kind of had just been weaned. Their moms went back to sea, and so they wanted to cuddle with anything. So they, you know, if you sat on the beach, they'd scooch up to you and sort of huddle against you. And it was flattering until we saw they were doing it to our duffel bags as well. These are king penguins in the background. And this lower picture is a southern royal albatross, which has a 10 to 12 foot wingspan on Campbell Island. And on this trip for Condé Nast Traveler, I sort of connected with the expedition leader, and nothing happened, but we decided we wanted to see each other again. And so after some emailing, he said, well, if you can get back down here, this would be February 2016, you can go to Antarctica with me. And so I got on a 5-week trip to Antarctica with someone I barely knew, which I've written about for the New York Times. So if you want a more detailed account, you can Google that. And I've learned that I need to say what happened, or otherwise people are very curious, which is that we were together for a while, but someone who is 30 years older than you and spends all his time on the high seas is difficult to maintain a relationship with. But it really changed my life. And so I went on this trip with him to the Ross Sea down here. Most Antarctic trips go to the Antarctic Peninsula from South America, and it's spectacularly beautiful, but you don't go that far south. You don't usually cross the Antarctic Circle, which is here at 66 degrees. And we went to 78 degrees south. And so I could see the region of Antarctica where Marion disappeared from. This is what it looks like. These are transantarctic mountains. This was Robert Falcon Scott's hut from which he departed on his failed attempt on the South Pole. These are molting emperor penguins in Mount Erebus. And this is a spectacular place. It's so wild, it's so remote. And sort of in this is the Ross Ice Shelf, which is about the size of France. It's a floating shelf of ice. And it's where some of the early explorers would establish their bases and where Little America was. And so kind of in doing this travel writing and meeting people who spend their lives in the wilderness also started to inform the character of Marion. You know, they're people driven by this desire to see as much of the world as possible. And it also started to change my life because I started to spend a lot of time away from home on these trips. I sort of expanded my risk taking. That's me with my mom. This was my second trip to Antarctica, to the peninsula. And so, I never took flying lessons, but I would seek out opportunities to fly. This was a travel assignment in the Canadian High Arctic, and we used this twin otter, turbo otter, to get to this island, Beachy Island, where there were some graves from the Franklin expedition. And then flying back to this lodge, the clouds kept dropping lower and lower. So we flew across the Arctic Ocean, the Northwest Passage, really, for about an hour at 140 feet. And then it took three tries to land on just a dirt landing strip because there's a strong crosswind. So that was educational as well. So Antarctica figures into the book. Even going twice, I'd only been, of course, on a ship around the fringes of it. And it was important to me to get a sense of what the interior was like, because this would be Marion's sort of greatest hurdle. And it's prohibitively expensive to get there. But I pitched a story about the National Guard pilots who do our polar airlift in Antarctica. And in the northern summer, they train in Greenland. So I flew in the back of a C-130 like this one, which is equipped with skis. From upstate New York to Greenland, and then we landed on the Greenland ice sheet or ice cap. And so I had this moment of standing in this perfect white disk of snow and ice under this dome of sky, and it really gave me a sense of, you know, the shape of the planet and the scale of it, which is what I was after. This is a glider flight I went on. Actually, this is the only time I've been in control of a plane, although I did not fly this loop. I just made a turn. Decided it wasn't for me, but the pilot offered to do a loop, and that was also helpful for me with the book because Marion does aerobatics, and I got the sense of the sort of increased g-forces and the weightlessness and what that would be like. It's a good thing there's no sound because I'm just laughing in a terrified fashion. And I went back to Missoula once I knew again more what I needed to know, and I could check out sort of what I wanted to see for individual scenes. There's a scene in the book where Marion rides her horse up Mount Jumbo early in the morning. That's this mountain. And so I hiked up early in the morning, saw what she would see, made sure I had it right. And then this really serendipitous thing happened where I was at the Aviation Museum there. And these two guys were pushing out this antique aircraft, and they said, "Tell that lady if she wants to come along, she can come." And turned out that was me. And so I got to go up in this 1927 Traveler 6000. And that was the plane I decided to have Marion learn to fly, because I'd seen it and I'd smelt it and I'd been in it and I'd taken video of Missoula from it. So I had this amazing source of information just through the generosity of these strangers. It was really cool. This is just a really brief clip of what it looked like flying from this plane. That's the Bitterroot River south of Missoula, and a view of the valley. This is the finished draft of Great Circle with a beer can for scale. Like I said, it was 980 pages, which would be shorter if it were typeset. Like, the book typeset is 580 pages, but it would still be 750 manuscript pages. So I did trim about 25% of the length, which was really an undertaking, but I think dramatically improved the rhythm of the book the way I did it, which was mostly small cuts. And this is These are some things that have happened since the book came out, and it was such a long, sort of laborious process, living in my own imaginary world, you know, hoping this book would, that I could even bring it together, because I didn't know what the plot was. You know, I was working for years without knowing how it would end. And it was just really frightening at times. And so it's been really satisfying for it to be a concrete object that other people can read. This picture in the upper left is, before it was published, I had to sign 2,500 copies for bookstores. And ordinarily you would go to a warehouse, but because of COVID, they shipped them all to my parents' garage. So, you know, you don't think that sounds like that many books, but it was like four pallets of books and it took more than a week to sign them all. Great Circle is a Today Show book club pick. So there I am. This picture looks sort of fake, but I did talk via Zoom with Hoda and Jenna. There's a billboard for it in New York. And then that is me at the Booker Prizes in November. And there it is. So yeah, thank you so much for listening to me chatter away. And I see some questions showing up. I think Jason's going to come back and help me out. So yeah, hit me with what you got.
Okay, let's jump in. Thank you for that, by the way.
Of course.
I have many questions, but for once, I'll jump to the front of the line. So Cheryl asks, your descriptions of the mechanics of flying seem quite detailed and implied to me while reading an understanding of how it feels to fly and what rudders to use, et cetera. How do you manage that in your writing? I feel like I'm almost there at times. It's truly a gift. Now, yeah, we saw all those books, which I only recognize the Scott Berg, Lindbergh biography. Now, the books are part of it, but I mean, yeah, what else?
I mean, I really did just read. I used videos as well, particularly instructional videos. There are historic ones, even from the war, where they sort of spell out, you know, step by step how to fly. I used instructional books from the time, and then things like the aerobatics, I really just found detailed accounts and then tried to sort of finesse them to sort of fit with the rhythm of fiction. But it was always a little bit suspenseful, and I would send the more technically involved sections to my brother too, and just be like, does this raise any red flags? But of course, flying has changed so much too. He wouldn't always know. So yeah, it's always nice to hear that it felt correct to people.
Ryland asks, your time and devotion to Antarctica are so rich. I wonder if there's another book you're thinking of setting in that environment.
You know, I sort of thought about it. I've been struggling to start my next book. I'm now in it, I believe, but it's sort of evolved from bits and pieces of abandoned projects. And I had started writing a story that was just spiraling into novel, set on an Antarctic cruise or a expedition travel type thing. Partly because I find the dynamics on cruises to be really interesting. People are sort of trapped together and are suddenly, especially in an environment like Antarctica, especially in the Ross Sea, suddenly sort of out of control. And what that can do to people. So I toyed with it. What I'm writing now will not have to do with Antarctica, but I would not rule it out down the road. But yeah, I think it's a fascinating place and I like to read about it. So hopefully other people do.
Well, you know, I had one question as much more amateur enthusiast of this stuff. And I had to look it up to get the name exactly right. Just out of curiosity, I think anytime there's a female aviator, aviatrix, whatever, there's some Amelia Earhart adjacent curiosity. Were you tempted to jump in there, or I don't know, is it just one of those figures that looms too large?
Yeah, you know, I was never tempted to write sort of, there's so many, you know, works of fiction that are about historic people. I was never tempted to do that. She was someone I thought about a lot when I was starting the book, mostly because I was really interested in how people process disappearance and death differently, even though they're often or usually the same thing. And I think Amelia Earhart, you know, almost certainly crashed in the ocean and drowned. And people have a really hard time accepting or processing that. And I was sort of intrigued by why. you know, I think some of it has to do with her being a woman and sort of this vibrant presence. It's just sad, you know, that that's how it ended. And there's sort of this cottage industry about being like, oh, I found this jar on this island. Like, you know, if you send me money, I'll go back and investigate further. And the next year, there's no mention of the jar, but there's a bone, you know. And, you know, why is this sort of unlikely myth built around this person? So I did think a lot about her. And it's also interesting because at the time in the 20s and 30s, there were a lot of pilots and a lot of female pilots who were very famous, like household names, but for reasons like setting a speed record, like people really paid attention to kind of the nitty gritty of aviation. And they're, you know, more or less forgotten with a few exceptions, like Beryl Markham because of her book, but like Eleanor Smith is a pilot who's hugely famous and we don't talk about. So, but I think that's because none of them came to sort of the spectacular end that Amelia Earhart did. So I did do a lot of research into lots of different female pilots.
Right. Well, that answers my question about the coconut crabs of Nikumaroro Island. Okay. Next up.
Well, my favorite one, just to do another little Amelia thing, is that photo that got passed around the internet a few years ago, and everyone was like, oh, that's Amelia Earhart watching her plane be towed behind a freighter. And I was like, what? Like, if she was a prisoner, why is she sitting on the dock? Like, that looks like a man to me. Why would her ship be, or her airplane be towed? Like, none of it made any sense. But if you suggest that this might be, you know, the key to the mystery, everyone latches on. And then there's never like the corrective, you know, doesn't get passed around the internet that actually that photo was taken years before her flight. So,
right. It's a piece of driftwood. No, it's the Loch Ness Monster.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So Barbara asks, in your research, how did you come up with the Navy painters?
Yeah, so Marion's twin brother, Jamie, is an artist. And during the war, he's a combat artist. So much of the book really came out of, as I was researching, I just come across something that interested me. And this was not an exception. I can't remember what I was looking for, but there's a PBS documentary called They Drew Fire. I think you can watch the whole thing on YouTube. I just stumbled across it. And it was about these combat artists and each of the services, I believe starting in World War I, would send artists into combat zones with the mission of, it was called, or they would say, capture the spirit or essence of war, which is trickily done, but I've always found that insight to be really interesting, that you get something different from a painting or a drawing than a photograph, because of course there are photographers as well. So yeah, this seemed to me like something that would make sense for Jamie in the war and something that was interesting to me. And I could also use existing paintings as sort of starting points for what he would have painted. And one of these artists, his name is William Draper, was in the Aleutian Islands in Alaska, which is where Jamie goes. So yeah, random chance, but really helped.
There's a question. When is the movie coming out? Is there one? Is anything else being adapted?
So it's optioned right now for a series, a TV series. And the production company that optioned it has hired a writer. I mean, I'm always very, I'll believe it when I see it about these things. Like there's so many hurdles and this would be such an expensive TV series to make. So it's like, you know, the writer and the production company will write at least a pilot, maybe more, attach hopefully an actress, take it out. And then there are about four companies that could pay for it. So, you know, we'll see. It wouldn't be for a couple years, at least, even if everything went like clockwork. And my other books have also been optioned. Senior Arrangements was optioned 3 times. And Astonish Me had been optioned for stage, I believe. And it just, you know, sometimes it just never goes anywhere. So I try not to get too invested in the idea, but I would really like to see it.
Well, I thought you said something very interesting. So amidst your travels in the, I think you said the airport in New Zealand, you know, you saw this flyer who your character is largely based on. And you explored that, but I mean, it made me wonder a bit, you know, what are you seeing now in your travels for, I mean, are you having, you know, and I think this is an inevitable question for writers right now, but also I think an important one historically. not just what is your inspiration looking like, but how are you drawing that? You know, obviously the world around you is, you know, figures heavily into your work. How is it figuring in right now when, you know, travel is so much more difficult?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was interesting in a few ways. When the pandemic really started, I had pretty much finished this book. I think we did one more draft, maybe in early COVID when everything was locked down. And then, you know, I turned my attention to the next thing. And my agent's advice all along through my career, and part of the reason why Seating Arrangements and Astonish Me are so close together, she was like, have something going, because when a book comes out, it feels like life or death. And it's just better if you have some forward momentum on something else. And so I was like, okay, I want to get something going before Great Circle comes out. And in some ways, the COVID seemed like it would be conducive to writing, because it was this quiet, empty time, you know, that I always have needed. But it turned out it really wasn't. And with my other books, like even when I was traveling, I would go, like when I was in Paris for 3 months, I would go out and work in Starbucks, just because I know it's not very romantic, but you know, they have electrical outlets and they let you stay and they give you huge coffees. Or when I'm home in LA, I'd take my computer to a coffee shop. And I think I needed that stimulation of just people being around and life happening. And so it really wasn't the pandemic really hasn't been a productive time. And because I think my next book is going to be set mostly in LA and just mostly about a family, I'm trying to really sort of simplify and contract. So I haven't felt the loss of travel as far as research. And in some ways, you know, I was starting to burn out a little bit. Like in 2019, I was out of the country for more than 100 days. And I've just started traveling again for work. I was in French Polynesia for all of February, and I'm about to go to Fiji. So I don't know why I'm on this South Pacific kick. But, you know, I do think it's just helpful to have a sense of things happening to you and of having the sort of stimulation of newness from travel, even if it's not directly going in the book.
Yeah. Fiji sounds difficult. I'm very sorry that.
I know. Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah. Well, the French Polynesia story was good. I went and you have to have a negative PCR test to get on your flight from within 24 hours, which I had. And then I landed and I was positive because they swab your nose at the airport. And so I had to quarantine for a week in Tahiti and miss the cruise I was supposed to go on. And so I ended up staying for a month instead of 2 weeks. So it was a reminder that things are still different.
Yeah, I had a friend that just got quarantined in Tahiti, so you know, at least it's Tahiti.
Oh, it happens. Yeah.
would love to hear your take and tack on The Group, capitalized T, capitalized G, The Group, and how you knew the book wasn't working.
Sure. Yeah. This was Mary McCarthy novel that I really like, about a group of college sort of friends is a little strong. They're sort of frenemies sometimes. It's been so long since I tried to write this that I don't even remember the specifics, but it sort of brought it to now. I was trying to write a little bit about Southern California, where I'm from. Sorry if you hear a lawnmower outside. And it felt like paper dolls as I was writing. Like I need a sense of momentum, but it felt like I was just sort of moving the characters around. I didn't really know who they were. I wasn't sure if I was interested in it. And I think it's possible if I had stuck with the idea when I started writing, and I probably wrote between 50 and 100 pages, I might have been able to power through. But because I let myself get distracted and write Astonish Me, Astonish Me is the most fun I'll ever have writing a book, because it felt like I was cheating on like the book I was actually supposed to be writing. And so I just wrote it so quickly in this sort of gleeful feeling, not even knowing it would be a book. And then when I tried to go back to the other project, to The Group thing, I just didn't have that feeling, and the contrast was really obvious. And I did start to realize too that there were a number of books that had sort of done the same thing. So I've had that feeling other times when I've started writing something, and then now I can identify it a little sooner, I think, when it's dead, but it's never great.
Right. Out of curiosity, as you're a Southern California native, is there a quintessential book for you, not like the, but is there one for you that hits your experience?
Not really. Or not that I can think of. I'm terrible at like recalling books. I'm staring at my bookshelves to see if anything leaps to mind. Yeah, no, I mean I'll be drawn to books about Hollywood. But I don't have one real go-to. No.
But and that was something else that and someone else was asking in a question that people are really focusing on the aviation aspect of this novel, in questions and stuff. Are you finding that people are examining that as much as kind of the Hollywood angle?
I think, yeah, we end up talking. When I talk about the book, I talk a lot more about the historic aspect, some of which is just the weight between the two stories. Marion's story takes up so many more pages, and I think sort of it has more obvious things to ask about. And the Hollywood part was for me as I was writing it. I mean, part of the reason I included it was that I thought it was fun. It was great to be able to write something without having to stop and like order a used book, and wait 3 days for it to arrive because I had some super specific question. And just being able to use the Hollywood parts are in a first person as opposed to the third person historic parts too. And so just being able to like really sit in a character's voice, that was great. And it was also a way to just process because I was newly arrived in LA when I started writing. And so, being exposed to sort of the industry more, is also kind of a fun way to riff on that, using even stories people are familiar with, like Hadley has a lot in common with Kristen Stewart in a way, and sort of to write about, if you're the star of this romantic film franchise and you're dating your co-star, people tend to put all this weight on that real life relationship that's more connected to the fiction. So it's also a way to sort of, rely in some ways on stories that readers might already know and play with them.
Okay, there's a couple more came in. And so ultimately, I think what this person is asking, once your brother read the book, and we were talking about this, like something that I love about events and people coming up to the signing table and going, you got this one thing wrong. What did your brother say after he read the book about all of the aviation insights?
I think it was fine. I mean, I've heard from a lot of pilots, which has been great. There hasn't been, I'm sure there's small mistakes. I did get one super long email that detailed some small mistakes that I was kind of like, I don't know, and it was also like, just so you know, ice isn't always white. And I was like, I think I've seen some ice. So yeah, I think my brother, yeah, the book is dedicated to him. So in some ways, and it is also, there's a lot in the book about sibling love. So I think it resonated with him, and I think the flying parts passed muster with him.
And finally, how did you come up with the title? Were there competing ideas for a title?
This was my only book where I had the title from the beginning. The other two came later. Seating arrangements, we titled right before my agent sent it out to editors, and used one of the chapter titles. So she came up with that. Astonish Me, we sort of brainstormed when I was midway through. And then this I knew from the beginning. When I think when I thought about, I wanted to write about a pilot who vanishes, and I didn't want her to vanish on a equatorial flight like Amelia Earhart, because I was trying to put some distance between her and Amelia Earhart, and I was more interested in the poles anyway. So when you start reading about that, great circle is a term that appears quickly because all lines of longitude are great circles, as is the equator. And so to me, that felt the concept of a great circle, the fact that there are infinite numbers of great circles intersecting 2 points on a sphere. Said something connected to what I wanted to say about, the sort of infinite variety of life and possibilities. So having that title was really helpful as kind of a guiding light. Although what I have learned is that I should have called it The Great Circle because everyone wants to call it The Great Circle so desperately. Like even my publisher, post on Instagram and called The Great Circle. And when we were talking about it, it's like, are you sure you don't want to call it The Great Circle? And I was like, no, because it's not one great circle, it's the idea of the great circle. And I was really resistant, but in retrospect, I should have just given in because everyone calls it that anyway.
Well, at least now you know. So thank you so much. Here's hoping we have you in person in our auditorium for the next book. And
That would be lovely.
thanks again, and congratulations on all its success. And
Oh, thanks
yeah,
so
and thank
much.
you everybody for watching, and night, Maggie.
No, thanks everybody. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author-events.